Welcome to the Hyperion Hub, your meeting place for all things Disney. Now your hosts.
Hello and welcome to the Hyperion Hub, your meeting place for all things Disney. I'm John Alois and I'm joined by Sean Degenhart.
Hey, heidi ho.
And John Redling Schaefer.
Hello, how are you?
We're coming to you from the Peoria Riverfront Museum in Peoria, Illinois, which is the site of Disney Fest 2024. And before we get to that, I want to remind you we are on social media. Engage with us there. You can send us an email or a voice recorded message at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. Wherever you're listening to us, please subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review. It helps more people find our show. We have two special guests with us this week. He is avid Disney collector and one of the sponsors for this weekend in Peoria. Steve Spain is with us. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having us, and thanks for your help in promoting the event.
Of course. And we're thrilled to be welcoming a return guest to the Hyperion Hub. Author and historian J.B. Kaufman joins us. Among the books he's written are Mickey Mouse, The Ultimate History, The Fairest One of All, The Making of Walt Disney's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Pinocchio, The Making of the Disney Epic, Walt Disney's Silly Symphonies, a companion to the classic cartoon series, and more. Thank you so much, JB, for once again joining us.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back again. And I should point out that two of those books were co-written with other people. So
you want to say their names for us?
Yeah, if I can remember them. No, the Mickey Mouse book I co-wrote with David Gerstein. Mm-hmm. And the Silly Symphony book was co-written with my very good friend Russell Merritt, who left us about this time last year.
Yeah.
So it is doubly precious to me to have been able to do that with him.
That's awesome. I have both of those books and love them immensely. We like to kick things off with our Disney views, and we're going to talk about night one of the Disney Fest, which took place here in Peoria, Illinois. We had a trivia contest last night. Steve, how did that go?
Oh, it was a lot of fun. We had... I forget how many people, but the place was packed, and it was, when you have a bunch of Disney nerds get together like that, and I was waiting in line, and a girl came up to me and said, yeah, this is a lot of fun. It's only in Disney events can you go up to a total stranger and start a conversation, and I thought that was true, but it was a lot of fun.
And you were dressed as?
I didn't wear a cop, but I wore my prized Tiki Room Disney Hawaiian shirt.
Excellent.
Thing.
That's great. JB, tell me about your experience last night. I assume you enjoyed the early portions, maybe of the event. I think they started early in the 1920s and moved forward. Correct?
Exactly, and you're right. That's where I live, so I was fine with that part. Then we got to the other part, and I learned a lot. So that was good too.
So where your expertise does it kind of move up until Walt's passing, or does it go past that?
Well, there are levels of this. You know, there are just different concentrations. I tell my students that the golden age of Hollywood was the teens, the 20s, the 30s, and when I'm in a good mood, the 40s. And that pretty much applies to my knowledge of the animated films too. So that's pretty much the area that I focus on.
And past guest of the Hyperion Hub, Chip Joyce, was the one that was moderating that panel. And I know earlier he had posted some of his research books that he was using for some of the trivia questions he was asking. So I was unfortunately able to be there, but I'm sure the questions were just outstanding and thought-provoking.
Yeah, he really got into the weeds for some of those questions.
So what was the format? I guess I want to know how many rounds. I mean, was this a 5-6 hour event, or how did this go?
I believe there were 6 rounds, starting with the early years and moving up, Golden Age, Silver Age, after Walt's passing, and so on. But Chip did a great job, and I would say our table, we represented ourselves well.
Yeah, in fact, some of us felt a little bit guilty about that because he did really get into some deep details on the earlier films, and those of us who love those films had an advantage with that.
What would you say was the most difficult question that was asked last night?
some of the TV series, some of the latter day TV series.
How about your wheelhouse? Like what from those 20s, 30s, 40s? Were there some in there that maybe you weren't aware of? Hadn't remembered.
There were some where teamwork really came in handy. You know, each round ended with a visual. He would show a character and ask you to identify the character and the film. And for one of them, the character was the knight from the story of The Reluctant Dragon.
Oh.
And I remembered the film, but I was blocking on the name of the character. And Derek Schultz at our table, he was the one who remembered it was Sir Giles.
Wow, that is a deep dive. Well, this year for the fest, we have two feature-length animated films and Silly Symphony shorts. And let's start with the animated features. 1961's 101 Dalmatians, a very important film for the Disney studio as they were trying a new process. The company had lost money on the beautiful but very expensive Sleeping Beauty, and so they were trying a new technique. Can you talk to us about this new approach called xerography?
Well, it was a real game changer, and I think the interesting thing is that they were continuing to make animated features on a pretty steady basis. But they never just settled into a rut and repeated themselves. They were always experimenting and trying new things. And so the major new thing that they tried with this was this process that they had developed in collaboration with the Xerox company, whereby rather than taking the animator's pencil drawings and having them traced in ink onto cells, they used a variation on the Xerox process to transfer the pencil lines from the paper animation to the cells, and it was in some ways it was a cost saving move, but it also had an effect on the aesthetic side. It also made for an artistic statement, and so rather than the smooth, beautiful flowing lines that the inkers would traditionally have put on the cells, you had more kind of rough, scratchy lines, because even the cleanup drawings would have some of that rough, scratchy quality. And that came through on the screen. You would see characters sometimes with construction lines in their heads, if you looked close enough, and with, again, rough lines. And they also, because you want to have characters that blend into their environment. So they were changing the look of the character animation so radically that they needed to do something corresponding to that with the backgrounds. And so the backgrounds had some of that rough quality too. And I think that it was pretty much in line with the whole mid-century modern look that was popular at that time. We're talking about the late 50s and early 60s. And I think that 101 Dalmatians made its own kind of artistic statement just through using techniques like that.
As we, over the last 10, 15 years, have gone more toward the computer-generated animation, you hear stories about people saying, well, I'm losing my job. This is, you know, I can't move on with this. This is totally different. It's wrecking animation. Was there that sentiment at that time? Were people upset that they were maybe not doing the traditional ink and paint model and feeling like I'm being left behind? Or was this everybody on board with this new process?
My guess, I wasn't there, but my guess is that there was a whole range of reactions to that. Obviously, it wouldn't have happened if Walt and Roy hadn't been happy with it. So clearly they were. And I think there were critics who enjoyed the departure, the graphic departure in the look of the films. But I'm sure that undoubtedly there were people who missed that smooth, beautiful look of earlier films like Pinocchio, you know, where they, you've just got that gorgeous, smooth quality to the ink lines. And I'm sure that the inkers who were out of work probably didn't care for it too much either. So I would guess that it was a combination of things.
And then a quick follow-up. Do you think in some ways this was maybe a truer representation of the animators?
Well, the animators,
it was a more direct line.
Yeah, well, the animators thought so. You know, they were very happy with that, because the inkers, as good as they were, and some of them were fantastically talented, But as good as they were, they weren't giving you the, they couldn't possibly right. be giving you the exact line that the animator did. Mm-hmm. So, I think in the animators' minds, that was a big plus. And I think in general, I think that they saw this as a great step forward.
You know, I find it interesting. I'm hearing about this corporate collaboration. You know, we hear about that throughout the decades, usually on rides. Who's sponsoring this ride, right? I don't know much about how that interaction began between the two companies. And I'm here amongst countless experts. I'm just curious if anybody can weigh in on how that even got started. Who was it, Disney that approached Xerox, vice versa? What do we know about that?
Well, I have to confess that there's not a lot I know about that. I have to tell you right up front here that 1961 is a little late for me. But
not your wheelhouse.
However, if I had to guess, I would guess that UB iWorks had something to do with it, because he was making so many technological contributions to live action and animated films around this time. So I would be very much surprised if he weren't involved in that.
Was one of the reasons, and I can't remember exactly, but I think one of the reasons why they went to this process was because of the Dalmatians in general, correct?
That's my understanding, because it made everything easier, but it made some things a whole lot easier. The great Warner Brothers director Chuck Jones was quoted as saying, "Leave it to Disney to make a picture with 101 spotted dogs. We have trouble doing one spotted dog."
Excellent. Was this a surprise hit for Walt at the time? Because it did very well.
I don't know about the surprise element, but I think it was a relief anyway, you know, because as you mentioned, Sleeping Beauty had been enormously expensive and had not done that well financially at the box office. So to have a film like this that did give so much of a return on the investment, I think that was a great relief.
Yeah, $3 million to make about, and it grossed $14 million in its initial release. It was a very positive time for Walt and for the Disney company. You had Disneyland was about 6 years old and growing. You had Mary Poppins on the horizon and other musical live action films. And of course, just starting to think about the Florida project. So a very positive time for the company.
I think so. Yeah. I think there was a real explosion there really in the, all through the 50s, but yeah, they were riding the crest of that wave, I think at this time.
And I think it's a testament to the company that you can have so many different animation styles through the years, but you still recognize it as Disney.
That's true, and that's a kind of remarkable thing. You know, my usual area of focus is a little earlier than that, and I've often thought that those first five major features, which we sometimes think of as the Big Five, there's not one consistent style through mm-hmm. all of them. They find a graphic approach that works for that story, and so that film will have a unique style of its own. And in the case of Fantasia, more than one, because you know you have the different components that each call for kind of a variation of graphic approaches. So yeah, I think that they took pride in that versatility, in being able to pivot to a somewhat different style depending on the story.
And something you just mentioned I hadn't thought of, I mean, the animation style itself contributes to the story that is being told.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, you know, it's, I don't know how deep we want to get into this, but a lot
Keep
of the
going.
Time, a lot of the time when people talk about animation, what they're talking about is the story or the color or the music or any number of things other than the actual animation, the movement of the figures. Mm-hmm. And that is something that the general audience may not always fully appreciate, but I think it was always on Walt's mind. It's not enough that the characters move. The quality of the movement was uppermost in his mind. And you see a lot of refinement of that in the various films too.
Let's move back to 1955. One of the other films being shown this weekend is Lady and the Tramp. And this comes out about a month before Disneyland opens. I don't know how much influence Walt had on the creation of the movie. I know he had a lot of ideas that were maybe used in the film. Can you tell us some nuggets we might not know about Lady and the Tramp?
Well, you guys are in command of a lot of nuggets here. So
it's the six-piece meal, not the four-piece meal.
Right, right. No, I think it's a fascinating film, and it's, you may know that it's the combination of two stories. The first one came from Joe Grant, who he and his wife had acquired a pet in the early 40s, and so he was developing at that time. This is a good 14 or 15 years before the film was finished. He was developing a story about Lady. And there were all kinds of conferences about that. And of course, being Joe Grant, he churned out a great quantity of artwork for that. And it never quite gelled at that time. But then there was a separate story written by Ward Green, who had been the head of King Features, about a happy mongrel dog who owed allegiance to no master's leash or anything. He was out on his own and enjoying his life of freedom. And eventually those two dogs got together and you know they combined those stories into one, which is kind of really emblematic of the Disney studio at its best, taking a whole range of ideas and sifting them together to the combination that turns out to work the best. I think that's where the Disney studio really excelled, I think. And it's such a wonderful film. You know, if the process needed to be vindicated, that film would vindicate it. I love it. One of the things that I love about it is the music. You know, you may know the incidental score is written by Ollie Wallace, who had already long since earned his stripes. But the songs brought in Peggy Lee, and I'm a fan of Peggy Lee, and she had really come into her own during all those years since the first Lady story was introduced. At that time, she had been a band singer for Benny Goodman. And then she kind of, her career took off from there, and she was, by the early 50s, she was really, really popular as a singer, but she was also doing very well for herself as a songwriter. And she and her songwriting partner, Sonny Burke, wrote all of the songs for Lady and the Tramp. Of course, there is that character, Peg, who sings He's a Tramp, at the way people would expect to hear Peggy Lee singing. You know, they couldn't not do that.
Very saucy.
Yeah, yeah, very, very saucy. And the dog is named Peg, in case anybody missed the point. But what a lot of people overlook is that she was a really versatile singer, and she is also the voice of the mother. You know, right after her baby is born, she sings the lullaby, and it's a lovely, touching little song, which is not at all what people would be expecting from Peggy Lee. So I think that was a real plus, too.
And tying in with the opening song and with the opening of Disneyland was Donald Novus sang the title track, who was also, you know, the Golden Horseshoe.
The title track.
For Lady and the Tramp.
So
the Christmas song.
Gotcha.
Peace on Earth.
Peace on Earth.
And he was a veteran of Disney. He had also sung Love is a Song in Bambi. Yeah. So, you know, he had a whole career of his own. He was popular apart from this. But yeah, he had a track record with Disney already.
How does a story like The Hat Box, so Walt gives his wife, Lillian, a hat box, and it has a puppy in it, and that story ends up making it into that film. Have you ever uncovered how exactly that was grabbed from the animators and placed into the film, anything like that?
I can't point to the story conferences or anything. I haven't really researched that one in depth, but I don't think it's a coincidence. You know, I think, in fact, I love the way that they incorporated their life experiences into the stories. Needless to say, including Walt's life experiences. You know, that would be a good hunch for any of the writers.
Talk about Walt's fondness for animals in general. It's one thing to make animals the heroes and villains of a film, but to treat them as if they were actual animals, they're pets in these two movies in particular, but still make them the main characters of the movies. He loved animals going back to his Midwestern farming days, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I think to anybody who loves animals, that speaks for itself. You know, you don't need to explain that. I think it's a sign of character if you love animals. And I have to admit, I'm a dog person myself. So to me, it's the most natural thing in the world. But yeah, it's when you see some of these films, not only these two, but for example, Pluto in so many of the shorts. When you look at some of the animation of Pluto by Norm Ferguson and other great artists, you can tell that you're looking at the work of someone who has observed dogs in action. And you're seeing cartoon exaggeration, but it's based on the actual movements of dogs. And of course, Lady and the Tramp and 101 Dalmatians both are pitched at different levels of fantasy. So it is imperative that you know something about the actual anatomy of a dog, more than you would need to know for Pluto. Mm-hmm. And you can animate movements that have cartoon exaggeration, but they are clearly based in a reality that the audience instinctively recognizes.
Yeah, it's one thing to give them human characteristics, but the animators studied these animals. You can tell.
Absolutely, absolutely, and in both films, mm-hmm. You know, you see the signs of that, in spite of the fact that they have very different graphic styles.
Tell us a little bit about the Silly Symphony shorts that you selected for this weekend and why.
Well, I had a lot of help from Steve, and if Steve has anything to say about that, I'd like to let him go first.
Well, thanks, JB. We both loved all the films we selected. My only thing that I was kind of, really dug deep on is I wanted The Ugly Duckling, the 1939, and to me, and we've talked, JB and I have talked before, to me it's a perfect little film. It's a heart-moving film. It's hard to do that in 8 minutes, but it does, and I just think that at some point in life we've all been at some place that we thought we didn't quite belong, and I think that is a very moving film, and that was my vote to have that one. So, JB, go ahead and with the others.
Well, that was beautifully put, and I agree with everything that Steve just said. We wanted to have a mixture because the audience here in Peoria is a really savvy audience, and there's a whole range. You know, there are people who are really familiar with these films. Other people who may be just discovering them for the first time but have an innate understanding of what makes a great animated film. So you wanted to have something that would appeal to that whole range of viewers. And so we have some of the textbook classics. We have The Skeleton Dance, the first Silly Symphony. We have Three Little Pigs, which you can't not do. You know, it's... I really believe that it probably is the most successful one-reel cartoon ever made. It was you may know this. It was a gigantic hit in 1933, and bigger
because of the music as well. I mean,
that was part of it. Yeah. Yes, that was a big part of it. And in fact, that kind of it was three. Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf was not the first original song to come from a Disney short. But you could say it was the first hit song. It actually was a major hit. It was recorded by jazz singers and orchestras, and it was published, and the sheet music was successful.
Used as an anthem during the Great Depression in some cases.
That's what we hear a lot. That people saw this film as an antidote to the Depression. It was a morale booster, and so. But for whatever reason, and personality animation had a lot to do with it too. You had beautiful personality animation in it by Fred Moore and Dick Lundy and Norm Ferguson, and a little bit by Art Babbitt. We don't want to overlook Mr. Babbitt. So it had all kinds of factors going for it. And, of course, they wanted all their films to be successful. Nobody, I think, anticipated how successful that one would be. So so that's on the program. On the other hand, Jenny Parkhurst, and I'd like to kind of send a shout-out to her.
From the Peoria Riverfront Museum.
Yeah. She has been just knocking herself out to stage this event. And because we have such a canine theme here with the two features, she was wondering whether there might be silly symphonies that had dogs in them. Well, as it happens, there were a couple, so we're showing those too. One is called Just Dogs and has a guest appearance by Pluto, and the other one is actually called Mother Pluto, and it's not one of the better known symphonies, but it's a really charming little film, and I think if people haven't seen it before, they will be pleasantly surprised. So it's a mixture of the well-known and the lesser-known.
JB, where can we find you online? Where can we find your books?
You can find my books wherever fine books are sold. At least you can find them online on Amazon or wherever. Some of them... I think the publishers think that they're out of print. I'm after some of those publishers about that. But there are more on the way.
Okay.
As for finding me online, probably the best place is my website, jbkaufman.com. I'll tell you what, this will be a Hyperion Hub exclusive. I mentioned that my good friend Russell Merritt passed away last year. The last creative work of his life, the two of us were working together to build a Walt in Wonderland website. And it wasn't finished at the time that he died. So I feel a double responsibility to finish that work and to put it online. And we haven't gone live yet, but we're getting close now.
Oh, excellent. Please let us know when that happens.
I will absolutely do that. We want to create a single sort of definitive online source for information about the Disney silent films. Thanks in large part to Russell's efforts, I think we're close to having that ready to go.
That's excellent. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's not there yet, but as a world leader might say, stand by.
Well, thank you for joining us, too.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I always enjoy talking with you folks.
We love having you. That'll do it for this week. Please make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. Leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps more people find the show. Email us at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. Follow us on social media as well. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.
We're glad you could join us. We'd love to hear from you. You can email or send us a recorded audio message at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. Find us on social media. The Hyperion Hub is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company or its subsidiaries. We'll meet you next time at the Hyperion Hub.